I'm Jeannie.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Nikki from Tyrion's Landing,
a podcast member of the Gonna Geek Network,
just like the one you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual.
Check out all the other podcasts at GonnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in...
3, 2, 1.
This is Camille Kajuri, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. And so you should. Keep your finger on the button and don't stop listening, because there's nothing better anywhere else.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive, reactive, proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry, if we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 248 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we've decided that this upbeat, positive Whovian discussion stuff isn't mixing it up enough. So instead, we're going to get blitzed on some wine we swipe from the rich dude's cellar, trash talk everyone within a 30-foot radius of us, and, just to keep things interesting, we'll vaporize a few people at random. It's like sweeps week for podcasts, y'all. I am your host, Haley Malley, and with me in the GPR studios this week, we have the one, the only, Keir Hansen. How are you tonight, Keir?
Well, there's one and only until I loop back on my own timeline, and then there's briefly two of me.
Well, and joining us this week to enjoy the break from show cohesion is a friend of the podcast, convention panelist, and professional British television viewer. No, seriously, it's his job. That's a real job that a person has. Don Cleese.
Hi, guys.
Great to have you here, sir.
Thank you.
This week, we are going to break into season 9 of classic Doctor Who. We're setting ourselves ahead in time to 1972 in our rewatch efforts as the Third Doctor and Joe Grant finally square off against the Psycho Salt Shakers in Day of the Daleks. Now, as Haley alluded to, it's a bit of a break from the Doctor Master pattern that the previous season really kind of worked into the ground, or perhaps underground, with some script decisions and some character behavior that kind of lends itself to some interesting discussion for a lot of reasons, continuity and otherwise. So top that all off with one of the longest running continuity arguments that the fandom has to this day, along with a fascinating update to the special effects and the audio in 2011 that really could be a whole nother conversation in and of itself. And you can see why this story is the fan favorite that it is. We always want to begin by pointing at Haley and saying, all right, as first-time viewer during these rewatches, what was your take on Day of the Daleks as a story in total?
Did somebody throw some money at Doctor Who this season? That was my first impression of this story.
Okay. Why so?
Just location shooting. Effects seemed to be like a lot more of them. And the ones they had were better. They had a huge cast, it seemed like.
Okay.
Lots of unit guys getting vaporized.
I'm going to ask this. Do you know whether or not you were watching the original edition or the updated 2011 special edition?
I have no idea. How would I know?
The voice of the Daleks. Uh-huh. Was it really painful to the ears, or was it Nick Briggs?
It was Nick Briggs. I mean, he was listed in the credits.
Okay.
But I always find the Dalek voice a little painful to the ears.
Yes. So to answer your question, yes, they threw a lot of money. Literally what they did to entertain, or that division of BBC when it came around to revisiting this for the DVD release, gave the go-ahead to the producer for that release to say, all right, we're going to go back, we're going to do some background location shoots for interviews and things that we were going to put on the extra credits. And as he looked and saw the condition of the grounds of what was that that big house that was apparently at one time the prime minister's estates, and it still looked in great condition, they said, you know, I could get in touch with some guys. We could probably do some things and clean up a lot of the errors, or I shouldn't say errors, but as he referred to it, sort of a nip and tuck to the original broadcast. So, Haley, what you've seen has been pretty dramatically enhanced in a lot of areas. Don, okay. what do you know about what went into, since I know this is it's going to be really difficult for us to separate the 72 release and the 2011 re-release, so we're going to have to jump back and forth. But what do you know about what went into this labor of love in rebuilding this?
Well, you know, the BBC, you know, we always talk about the BBC as if it's a monolithic entity. But the truth is, you know, there's the BBC, which is the broadcaster in the UK that has, you know, shown Doctor Who, in, you know, over five decades, give or take some time. And then there's the part of them that is that releases the programs on DVD and digital and all that for commercial purposes. And again, at some point, you know, as they were starting to go through the, you know, what we call the classic series, although I'm not enamored with that term, but the classic series, there was a decision made, you know, kind of around like 2009, 10, 11, where they said, you know what, let's see if there's things we can do to kind of spruce up some of these older stories where things were not as things might not be up to the expectations of a contemporary audience. But, you know, that's why you get things like, you know, Planet of Fire being, you know, cut down to, you know, 70 minutes in, you know, with spruced up special effect. It's why you get the release of Day of the Daleks, where they said, you know what, let's make this look a little bit more like the aesthetic people would expect of the contemporary series. And, you know, I mean, look, it was a commercial decision. You know, the on the one hand, the BBC is the most resolutely non-commercial company ever. And if it wasn't, we wouldn't be here today, because Doctor Who would never have been made by a commercial company. But they also knew, hey, you know what, there's an audience that is open to, you know, as you say, some nip and tuck here and there. You know, and look, even I think they kind of pegged it right. Even we as fans kind of like seeing a little bit of, you know, a little bit of judicious alteration, as long as it doesn't kind of mess with the overall feel of the story. Right. And I was watching it again last night and thought, you know what, that's, you know, did I think it needed it? You know, it's hard for me to say. I can't look at the show with the same with a lack of bias, you know, because, you know, it's part of my youth. It's part of, you know, it's I'm used to the way it was. But they did right by it. I think they, you know, it's not like when you watch the with Star Trek, you know, they've gone back and done all the CGI effects that just completely don't fit with the aesthetic of the original series.
Right.
But, you know, Briggs and company clearly said, you know what, if we're going to do this, we're going to make it look like it fits with, you know, 1971, 1972, whenever they filmed it.
Sure.
And, you know, it was, it's fun to watch. I mean, it's, you know, I suppose it's better is, of course, a subjective thing. I think from the standpoint of someone who's never seen it before, it's going to feel more dynamic. You know, I'm still, you know, one of those people who is has lived through the Star Wars special editions argument, so I'm not sure I can approach it without, you know, in a purely intellectual, as a purely intellectual exercise.
True. Well, Haley, to give you a little bit of an idea of some of the things that probably just absorbed into your watch without you even kind of noticing it, you talk about the cast size. A lot of the aspect are one of the reasons why, being the fan favorite that it is, because of just the nature of the story, the fact that they're doing a lot of playing around with time paradoxes and the things that we now really revel in when it gets worked into modern scripts. But apparently the cast really couldn't stand the story as it was originally put together. And one of the things that Pertwee himself kept kind of grumbling about was the fact that the unrealistic nature of the siege on the house in the fourth episode was done with essentially three Daleks. They had three Dalek shells and about four guys playing the Ograns, and they were apparently, you know, this massive siege. And the doctor's argument, or Pertwee's argument, was that there's absolutely no way they would have been able to accomplish anything with those numbers. So what they did is not only did they do a little bit of sort of screen manipulation, they didn't have a huge CGI budget or being able to do a lot of extra CSO or anything of that sort, but they did have one of the vintage cameras. They had one of the, I forget what millimeter they were using.
16.
Time. Was it 16 millimeter? Okay.
Yeah, that was standard for BBC film work at the time.
Okay. And they actually got one of the modern day Dalek makers, you know, one of the reproductions, and somebody who had a pretty passable Ogron cosplay, and they basically shot additional scenes to increase the numbers. And, you know, they shot them on the film canisters, and they degraded the film digitally to match what was in the original production, so that it all fit kind of seamlessly. And then obviously did some additional audio overlay. They put some smoke in and you know, got some actual laser fire. One of these days, you'll have to go back and watch the original just to see. I was watching both over the course of the past week. Julie walked into the room. She really wanted to see this one because she wanted to see how Pertwee was going to stack up against the Daleks. They had been basically boxed for, 5 years? We hadn't seen him on screen? So we hadn't seen him in color yet. So she wanted to see how it was. And she said, wow, this is really... She had the exact same response you did. She's like, this they really made a huge leap forward between 71 and 72. I'm like,
this is big time.
So we got to the end of the first episode where the Daleks are first speaking and you first see them having that conversation with the controller. By the way, the controller, Audrey's probably one of my favorite just bit characters. I think this guy's amazing. And he reminds me quite a bit of, maybe it's because of the silver sort of cast makeup they put on him, but I kept thinking Brent Spiner and Data. He just reminded me so physically.
I see that?
Yeah. Oh, anyway, but yeah, just
well, in my house, of course, you know, the thing we couldn't get past was, you know, he's the Candyman from Willy Wonka. So,
right.
You know, so it's like, you know, being in a, you know, my wife has forgotten more about musical theater than I'll ever know. So she's like, "Oh, I know that guy." And that, right. So it's one of those things where you're like, "Yeah, that's talented guy." You know, we forget, you know, that, you know, Doctor Who was getting, you know, at every stage of its life, was getting really good, talented character actors into the mix.
To this day, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're watching the end of this first episode. They're having this conversation back and forth. You've got the controllers on the small screen broadcasting back to the Daleks. And I said, all right, so hold on a second. And I flip back over to the original version and I give her that same 2 minutes. And she just, I can feel her staring at the side of my head. She's like, this is almost unwatchable. And I said, really? You think? And she's like, no, let me correct that. It's almost unlistenable. Because you essentially had, you know, coming into this production year, you had two new guys doing the voice of the Daleks. And they really had no kind of frame of reference. You know, talking into an old school analog ring modulator, and just weren't really sure exactly how it was going to work out. So Gilbert and Messaline just kind of clunked their way through it. And you can get some of the extras in the DVD where they literally will pan back and forth between the two audios, and you can hear what a dramatic improvement Nick Briggs does when he comes into it. But even he, under direction, held back a little bit. He does not do modern Daleks. He's down like a register or so. He doesn't get quite as frenetic as he does today, where they're just completely out of their minds and screeching all the time. So much thought went into this. But as far as the story itself, I mean, we get a lot of really great gifts from this one. You know, we get to play around with a quick little time jump, you know, get to play around a little bit with time paradoxes. Did it bother anyone else that we never got the resolution to the Doctor and Joe visiting the Doctor and Joe?
Yes.
Huh.
Or did that never even, the penny never dropped?
I think I always took it as a bit of a gimmick and never expected much of it.
I don't know. I just get it has become such a workhorse of time travel based science fiction these days that I always want to see the other side of the conversation resolved at some point. You know, it's like the chord progression. You have to resolve the chord progression by the end of the song. You can't leave it on a, you know, on an odd seventh or something.
I mean, but, you know, for what it does, although I will say for what it's worth, my youngest, who's as Keir knows from direct experience, is a huge classic series fan, was kind of grilling me about that same question because he was rewatching it with me because he knew I was doing this podcast this weekend. Mm-hmm. And so clearly, you know, my, you know, the fact that I just kind of sloughed it off is not representative of people with a grounding in, you know, the quote unquote classic series, because, mm-hmm. I've kind of let it go because there's lots of stuff in Pertwee's time that, as much as I love it, I just say, not going to think too much about that. Sure. But yeah, that's one where, you know, that nowadays, it would be dealt with in some form or fashion.
Right. Yeah. It becomes part of the clever repertoire. But we do get handed, as a result of that actual, the beginning of that little exchange, we get a very casual mention, which gets, you know, expounded upon much later, to the Blinovich limitation effect, which we're still toying with to this day. To have Blinovich dampeners and things of that sort too. So starting, Terrence Dix and company starting to toy around with ways to muck about with the timeline without worrying about a lot of continuity complaints that were going to come in from the fan base who were really watching and listening and itemizing the things that were getting discussed to a very granular level. I don't know how successful that was, because the Blinovich limitation effect has become one of those very things which gets discussed to a very granular level. But as far as this whole idea of the predestination and having to loop back on yourself, and all of this is bound to happen because you're here and you're discussing it, so it must have happened, and that sort of a thing, is this one of the first instances historically, I think, that where we've actually really put that sort of time paradox into the script? I'm trying to recall. I don't think there was even anything in the Second Doctor's era that really...
I think you're right. I think you're right that this is the first time, because the only other story I can think of from the, you know, the black and white period that where time was really an issue was the Space Museum. And that was kind of the gimmicky, you know, hey, they're out of sync with time. Mm. But, you know, once they, but after that first episode, then everything's happening kind of in the order you expect it to.
Right.
But yeah, I think that was the Day of the Daleks, I think, was the first case where you had to think, you know, this has happened in the future. This is that the future is somebody else's history and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they really started to, the dialogue really plays around a lot with the tenses on that as well. The Doctor almost takes a point of amusement with that. I want to discuss the Doctor specifically on this, because we get a very different Third Doctor here than we had through the entirety of the season prior. A little unexpected in his behaviors. Haley, what was your take on the wine swilling, gun toting, devil may care Doctor that we suddenly get thrown here in January of 72.
I mean, if somebody puts you in a big swank house with a well-stocked cellar, what, you're not going to go hit that up?
And the Gorgonzola was exquisite.
Bony, I said.
I think the only thing that was bothering me, because I mean, I genuinely enjoyed, you know, the fact that he could, you know, take down a would-be attacker and not spill a drop of his glass and everything, and he was just really on point through it all. But his demeanor just seemed like his sort of callousness, at least within the first two episodes, really ramped up. It hit the ground in a very strange way from the moment they leave the unit lab I would say just prior to that, the warmth between Katie and John was probably some of the best it's ever been. I mean, you could just tell that they really hit a groove. The two of them really riff off each other really well, and they enjoy each other's company. They enjoy working together, and their characters are really at that warm point. But then all of a sudden, as soon as he gets to that wine cellar, things take a turn to the point where he's shooting characters without a moment's hesitation, vaporizing them. And I'm still stuck on that to this day. And I don't know why that was given such a quick hand. I'm not sure if I've been able to resolve that in my heart of hearts.
It feels a little off. Yeah. Because I think there's an image of the Doctor. You know, I think the Terrence Dix quote, you know, neither cruel nor cowardly, which has been kind of riffed on, you know, variously in the show. You know, we think of him as the person who, you know, it's not that he, you know, that looks down on guns, you know, who would never need one. But, you know, clearly in Day of the Daleks, he was not above taking that step. Yeah, I mean, I have to look, as I said, I'm watching it with my son, and he's flagging that there for me. And I think, you know, clearly I had engaged in some sort of rationalization about, you know, why it didn't bother me. But I think that someone who has that image of the Doctor as someone who's kind of who is going to solve the problem, you know, with his mind, who's going to find the less violent way to do it. He clearly did not hold to that principle here. But, you know, but at the end of the day, I'm also going to give the Doctor the benefit of the doubt and say this was a case where, you know, more so than a lot of the unit stories, where you really did feel a tangible sense of peril for the whole world. Mm-hmm. You know, I think, like, you know, because as I'm, you know, thinking back on this story, and it was that thing in the back of my mind, and really reinforced when I rewatched it. You know, a lot of the unit stories, you know, if you were to look at it on paper, you'd say, oh yeah, clearly, if this happens and things kind of proceed from here without the Doctor stopping them, yes, the Earth is in a whole lot of trouble. You know, Claws of Axos and the demons and so forth. Mm-hmm. But in Day of the Daleks, when it's World War III on the table, you know, there's something very, visceral about that. That, you know, I mean, in fact, I think it's possibly the only one of the unit stories, the Earth-based unit stories, where you think, oh yeah, you know, this is a true emergency for the whole planet. That, you know, that, you know, that if this situation is not stopped, that it's game over.
Right.
You know, because I think, you know, otherwise you think, oh well, you know, there's the Doctor will do something really clever, and this will never get beyond the quaint English countryside. You know, mm-hmm. Claws of Axos again, the demons. At the end of the demons, everyone can be like, yeah, let's just have a pint. You know, we'll dance around the maypole. But, you know, in Day of the Daleks, you are told in no uncertain terms it's World War III if anything goes wrong.
Right.
You know,
leading to 100 years.
Yeah. Right, you know, right, exactly. And really, you know, I think in Doctor Who terms, even though the Daleks had been away for as long as they had, you know, I think there was still a sizable chunk of the audience that understood that Earth being under the control of the Daleks was as bad as it gets.
Right.
So if you make that connection, and the script does a good job of putting it out there, that, you know, if World War III happens, the Daleks take over. And again, that is as bad as it gets. So, you know, I'm kind of, as much as it kind of feels off for the Doctor to be using guns, I think that, you know, I am willing to kind of give him some slack, because, you know, that things are really, really bad, you know, and that the stakes are really, really high. So.
Well, and this Doctor has always been much less averse to violence than other Doctors that we've seen.
Mm, for certain.
I mean, down to the Venusian karate that we see all the time.
And we got quite a bit of demonstration of in this story. He was flipping people left and right. I'm just going to, my head is just going to put it away and say, you know what, the wine was slightly bad. You know, he got a little, you know, got a little tipsy on it, to the point where, I mean, even later, there was a lot of just, a lot of opportunity to get thoroughly soused through all this, because even when they're, you know, lounging on pillows with the controller later on, I mean, everybody's just, you know, free flowing. The bar is always open.
It's a good vintage.
Yeah, not to mention the fact, I mean, what is it when they make it through the night in the house? It's dawn, and he's already going to the bar to fill his glass. I mean, talk about day drinking. It was really, really impressive. Although, some other things that were really kind of standing out in mind here, because I'm going to leave one of the big ones off to the end here, because it's a huge conversation in and of itself. But it has to do with the idea of Anat, or, you know, you won't really hear her name often, but the leader of the Free Fighters, played by the absolutely gorgeous Anna Berry. I thought that was a great casting decision to have her as that position of authority. And I actually felt that out of all of the Freedom Fighters that we got a chance to hear from, for the most part, she was the one who had the most established identity and sense of purpose, whereas some of the others were just sort of reactionary, especially Shura, who just runs around wanting to clutch at his side and blow everything up. I'm really surprised that they didn't, that she doesn't stand out as much in conversations about the story since. I really don't hear a lot of people kind of boosting her character up. I was thoroughly pleased with that. I mean, as far as between her and the controller, I think a lot of the supporting cast in this story in particular was exceptionally well done.
You know what, what strikes me about her? Oh, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
No,
sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to agree.
I was thinking, a couple weeks back, you guys were talking about Colony in Space and about how the original plan had been for the bad guy to be played by a woman, mm-hmm. and that had been met with skepticism, shall we say, and
sure.
some rather bizarre, expression of psychological dysfunction mm-hmm. by the BBC management. Yeah. But, you know, I was thinking about that and thinking, you know, was this sort of, you know, Barry Letts and Terrence Dicks thinking, all right, fine, you know what, they have a problem with the woman as the villain. Well, let's cast, you know, this character who I think let's say, you know, if we were doing this story somewhere in the middle of Troughton's time on the show, mm-hmm. I think it's a pretty safe bet it would have been done as a male character.
Yeah.
And so I find myself thinking maybe this was, you know, Letts and Terrence Dix trying to say, well, we couldn't get away with it as the bad guy. Let's kind of get this role kind of on the books, shall we say, for, you know, at least for one of the good guys. Let's at least broaden the scope of what, you know, women in Doctor Who can do. I mean, you know, because I think that was very much as much as, you know, Terrence Dix has kind of owned up to, shall we say, some overly traditional view of heroic roles. Mm-hmm. I think he was always kind of up for, you know, the female characters to have a certain amount of agency in the series. And I think we see a bit of that here. You know, I think certainly in Barry Letts' parts, we see it here, you know, mm-hmm. that maybe they just wanted to have, you know, a female character who was really helping to drive the action even beyond what Joe's doing. Because, you know, Joe's in a category all her own. I know, I'm sure we'll talk about her later mm-hmm. on, but, you know, these roles, you know, Joe's role, Anat's role, you know, they'd be unthinkable, you know, a couple years earlier.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's you know, it's pretty cool. You know, as you know, we are still, certain segments of fandom are still wrestling with the concept of a female doctor. You know, clearly they need to revisit history and realize that the writing has been on the wall since the 1970s.
Yeah. I think this is as good a time as any to kind of discuss Joe in this as well, because it's we always find it as we're going through this era that it's a fascinating use of her character, and which writers, which script editors, directors decide to lean on or back off of what they know that Katie Manning was capable of doing, and what they've actually already written into the character. So here we finally get her using her escapology skills again. So that's a good one. I mean, that was established right from the jump and then completely cast aside. So, you know, kudos to Lewis Marks for picking up on the fact that that's a usable asset in any storyline. But it's, again, it we're going back to some of the things that we've been waiting for from her, you know, to stray away from the damsel issue, to nonetheless allow her to have a little bit more flirt time with Yates, you know, because that's, you know, who doesn't like a nice little romance in their story every once in a while, and just her. Her reactions to these increasingly perilous situations that she's getting put in. So now she's getting exposed to some of the dangers of time travel. You know, we got her off world just a little while ago, and she did not take well to that. But she, you know, she bit down and dealt with it, and now she's dealing with some of these issues with looping back on one's own timeline and everything else that goes along with it. And she's just sort of increasing her intellectual repertoire when it comes to traveling with the Doctor. Adding that to her toolbox, along with all of the inherent skills that her character has been given, that a lot of writers haven't thought to utilize yet. So I thought this was a really strong one for Jo Grant personally. Haley, I know you've really been kind of warming up to Jo from sort of a rocky start. How are we doing with her right now?
I liked her in this episode. She was a lot of fun. I don't know. I kind of always feel like I wish she was doing more. I feel like because they bring in so many other characters beyond just, you know, the Doctor and his companion during this era, you know, we've got all the unit people, and then there's usually a pretty large supporting cast for each episode. Mm-hmm. It leaves less for her to do.
Yeah, I can see that. Don, what do you know about, I mean, if you can limit yourself to not looking ahead in the story, so to speak, and sort of take your snapshot of where Katie Manning has established the character to date. Where do you think she's, where has she started to solidify the foundations of the Jo Grant that we know in retrospect?
You know, I would have to say that this is the season where, you know, where it happens, because she's really not out much beyond the kind of, slightly bumbling figure that you know, from the, what we'll call, you know, the master season, mm-hmm. you know, at, you know, up to the, you know, up to that point. But, you know, here's where I think, you know, we see her, you know, she disagrees with the Doctor, not, you know, I mean, and maybe she's wrong. You know, she kind of takes the controller at face value too easily. She is, you know, she's not maybe, you know, just cognizant of the,
It's kind of hard to blame her for trusting the controller, though, because the rebel people did try to kill her.
Fair point. Fair point.
Yeah, she's seeing it. I mean, she got caught in just the right circumstances to only see that side of the conflict. So it was pretty easy to manipulate her. And as the controller argues, he's in a position to be able to deal with the human condition in a way that the Daleks can't. So.
Speaking of the Master, every time there was some new ominous-looking dude with his hair slicked back, I was like, oh, is the Master back?
Yes, that back-swept hairstyle is a recipe for villainy.
Yeah, I couldn't get past the... I just kept looking for the, you know, the 70s mustaches, personally. There were, you know...
Some rather fantastic ones.
Well, that's how we knew the controller was special, because he had no facial hair.
Right. Okay, well, you've just opened the door for our discussion now. 70s mustaches. Was this the 70s? Where in the 70s, if it was the 70s? We have now broached upon something that Haley is just starting to get the tip of the iceberg in what can only be referred to as the unit dating conundrum.
I've heard of this.
Yeah, it's a mess. And to a certain degree, you'd almost think that it was intentionally a mess. And reason why I say that is because look at one of the inside... I don't know if it was meant as an inside joke in the way that that both Lewis Marks and then when Terry Dix went in and did some revisions to the script to actually insert the Daleks, because he actually wrote the story as called like The Ghost Hunters, didn't even have the Daleks in it. but they knew that this was going to be the season that they wanted to bring him back, so they worked it into the script. But they, you get that exchange where the controller's talking to Joe, and they're having this conversation. He says, "All right, well, you've told us the year, but what was the exact date?" And she says, "Oh, I remember clearly. It was September 13th, which, by the way, was the first day they started production on shooting it back in 71. But she never did say the year. Mm-hmm. And this becomes an issue. And Don, you're going to have to help me kind of embellish this, because I look at it, I'm seeing it from, I look at the unit dating conundrum from the eyes of Sarah Jane Smith, and I can't do anything but. But it is an issue about where the unit years, the Pertwee and unit years actually took place, and as far as real Earth time. Help me.
Oh my God.
Help me explain this.
Yeah. I mean, the God, I should have had a shot before even.
I'm glad we brought an expert.
This. Yeah. So, okay. The, you know, I mean, look, the whole, the premise seemed to be that, you know, it was meant to be kind of, you know, we use the expression, what was it with Max Headroom, you know, 15 minutes into the future or whatever.
Right. And Terrence, you know, Dix always said, that, and Nick Briggs has always backed this up, that they always saw the unit stories as being the day after tomorrow.
Right. And so I think that's why, again, in a story like Ambassadors of Death, you know, you've got the, you know, we're doing missions to Mars and all of that. And it's, everything's meant to be a little more technologically advanced than, you know, than we would have, you know, in real life. You know, mm-hmm. I guess that's, you know, which I guess as a slight digression, it's sort of the most pure science fiction the show has done, because it's been, let's take what we have in real life, you know, Apollo landing, moon landings and such, and just say, well, what if it happened a few years after that? Where would we be? Right. So I think maybe that was kind of the mindset that went into the unit period in Doctor Who. But the simple truth is that, you know, when you're doing five stories a year and, you know, 13 hours of television, and all of it on not nearly the budget you need, and you know and nobody really knows exactly for sure when stuff is meant to be set. You know, if you said everything is meant to be at least, you know, 10 years in the future or 5 years in the future, everybody could probably get their head around that. But I suspect that there was never any clear brief given as to, well, we want it to be just like Earth, except, you know, what it would be, you know, in this year. And so it's a mess. I mean, I think it was a mess at the time. Mm-hmm. But I think everybody kind of went with it. It's only because of the story Modern Undead, you know, several years later, you know, in Peter Davison's tenure, that it becomes an issue, because at that point they say, well, you know, the Brigadier left unit in this period, mm-hmm. and all that. You know, it's like once you start putting dates to it, you know, you're done. You know, your goose is cooked.
Right.
Because then you start thinking, well, wait a minute, if it was supposed to happen several years in the future, how can that possibly work out? Yeah. And, you know, I think the most compelling / comprehensible theory I've had on this is, well, it's meant as it is, which is pretty much in line with it's the day after tomorrow view of mm-hmm. everything's close to the time it was broadcast, but a little bit ahead of it. And that's why everything seems just a touch more advanced. The technology is a touch more flash than it would have been at the time. And, you know, so, and that's kind of that's really the only way you can kind of remotely make sense of it. But of course, as we know, nobody really wants to take a stand on it, which is why in Day of the Doctor, you know, there's jokes about what the dating protocols are, or, right. you know, Tennant in his story with the Suntarans, you know, jokes about, well, did I work for them in the 70s or the 80s? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think nowadays the view is to say, yeah, we know it doesn't quite add up, but let's just get on with telling a good story and not worry about, you know, we'll worry about the retconning implications, you know, over a pint, you know, outside of the story.
Yeah, because in short, Haley, they had made some. They had done a good job of dancing around using any hard dates in most episodes prior, but they were using frames of dates of things like, you know, where they would say, "Oh, well, this happened 40 years ago." You know, when we get to Carnival of Monsters, Joe says that the year 1926 was 40 years ago. And everyone says, "Oh, aha!" And they start latching onto that. But then, you know, a couple stories later, you've got somebody that says that, you know, that this happened, and then you've got Sarah Jane Smith who says at some point that she's from 1980, and that throws everything off as well. So, you know, it just as soon as you start putting actual pinnable dates in, everyone's going to start pointing fingers and say, no, it doesn't match up because you've been doing too much jumping around. It's the inherent nature and the problem with a show that has this kind of a malleability to it. So, yeah, and everything could have been okay until Modern Undead, I think, if they just avoided that mention of the 1976 Briggs retirement, which just screwed everything up. You probably could have just walked away from it, but... Yeah, so Haley, to just prepare for this to get worse and worse as our rewatch continues, because they're going to continue to screw this up as we go along here.
Yeah. By the way, I just want to put in my request now that when you get to Modern Undead, I want to do that rewatch because okay. That was literally one of the first Davison stories I ever saw. So okay. It's a personal favorite and one where you know where you think, God, you know, it's a case where sometimes I think as fans, sometimes miss the forest for the trees, because, you know, it seems like within a certain set of fandom, all everyone knows about that story is, yeah, that's the one that screwed up the unit dating stuff. Again, as if it was really that consistent to begin with, but, you know, so
it becomes the hated uncle at the wedding. Oh.
Exactly.
Uncle it's like, Louis just showed up.
Don't let him near the bar.
Be civil to him, but
right.
All right. I will mention though, there's one more thing that I would impress upon people to seek out. It's a very very small little short that they added on to the special edition. It was on the second disc, and it had to do with the cheating memory, as it was called. It was only about 5-6 minutes or so. And it was a quick conversation with a psychologist who also happened to be a Doctor Who fan, although I got a feeling that she didn't really know a lot of the classic material quite as well, but her input was exceptional. They were putting the before and after the specialization side by side. And they were showing, you know, some of the battle sequences where there was only a couple of, maybe a couple of blank pistols being fired on the original, and there was complete laser fire and guts flying and people getting vaporized and a splatter and all these things happening on the right-hand side of the screen. And through it all, she was discussing the fact that, that in our heads, looking back on something we were watching as children... especially young children around real formative viewing years, like 5, 6, 7 years old, that we, in retrospect, our minds embellish what had an impression on us then. So we remember them intensified from what we actually observed. And especially knowing something that aired back in the 70s, and you didn't have access to see anything about it again for at least 10 years or so, or perhaps even longer before you'd see something on VHS or something of that sort. And your only resource, maybe if you wanted to revisit that story, was to grab the novelization, which doesn't have the limitations of what's on screen. Your mind can go wherever you want with it, and it's written a little bit more elaborately too, especially things like the siege on the estate and such. So her point was that we were building this all up in our heads so that the special edition does something to kind of give us what we thought we remembered, so that if you go back to watch the pure as televised original, it doesn't seem quite as thin. You know, cleaning up some of the actors' gaffes and things, so that we wouldn't have noticed when we were kids because we were too busy waiting for the next alien gun battle to happen. We weren't really paying attention to the discussion of the politics and such. But really, really fascinating little piece. So I definitely seek that one out. If you haven't grabbed your library edition, grab the second disc of that set and watch that little piece. I want to take our little extra segment here and circle all the way back to something that that Haley referenced during the introduction. Can you indulge me for just a second here? Don, we've sat across each other on a couple of panels, both ones I've moderated, you've moderated. You've given your introduction to people and what you do for Acorn Media a couple of times in front of various crowds. And you've always joked a little bit about your profession, but please help me understand, what exactly are you being paid to do?
Oh, Lord, that's... Well, kudos to you for not tipping your hand too early, because I would have overthought my answer profoundly if you had.
Okay.
So, which would mean we'd be here all night, probably. Acorn has, for the last few decades, even before I joined them early on in 2000, has been in the business of releasing British television in the U.S. To give some perspective there. When I started at Acorn in January of 2000, post all that millennium bug, fear that we were all, consumed with at the time, we were just starting to release the Agatha Christie Poirot series on VHS.
Okay.
And then, 15 years later, we had gotten an Emmy nomination for premiering the very last episode of the Poirot series with David Suchet, on our streaming channel that we had, just started a few years earlier. So we've been in this business of putting out very, high quality British television, for many years. And, I had convinced the powers that be there that, I kind of knew the programming, knew the British TV, which, is fair to say, I'm part of that generation that grew up with Masterpiece Theater and, watching I, Claudius, even though I probably shouldn't have been watching it at that age.
Yeah.
But, I convinced someone that I would be a good person to help to figure out what shows were worth putting out, seeking out, for the U.S., actually, talking to people from the BBC and ITV and other, independent producers. And, I've been doing that for, coming up on, 15 years now in some form or fashion. But, I had to explain this at career day at my son's school last year. And, I'm pretty convinced the only part the kids remembered was when I said I got paid to watch television. But, there's a lot of talk about, peak TV, obviously with Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime, mm-hmm. all, putting out as much television programming as the traditional networks do. And, but there's a lot of, that's just in the U.S. There's a lot of programs being made in the U.K. And so, Acorn, we kind of, step in and say, that's a show we think, needs to be made. And if it takes a little bit of extra investment to get it going, then, that's what we want to do, because we want to bring, the best shows to the U.S. that we can, because we've been in the British TV business for a long time. Mm-hmm. And, we want to, we know there's a passion for it. We believe there was a passion for it, even when I think a lot of people in the space didn't, PBS didn't necessarily, had, I think maybe before Downton Abbey kind of took off, I think they were maybe feeling a little bit hesitant about how strong British TV was as a part of their programming. And, you know, we always believed in it, you know, because, you know, we'd been releasing, you know, Poirot and Doc Martin and, you know, Life on Mars and a host of other shows because mm-hmm. we knew that audience was there. You know, one of the proudest things I've done was to actually, you know, get a deal done that let us release Life on Mars, you know, with all the music intact, you know, every Bowie song in there, you know, all the, yeah. you know. You know, that which was that was God. You know, I remember I was talking to a person from the production company a few days before the show premiered in the UK. And I remember it so vividly because I had literally just gotten back from paternity leave for my third son, you know, the aforementioned Will, who, again, you've been on a panel with as well, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. which is kind of shocking to say, too. But but, you know, I had just gotten back and it took a couple years to get things in place because, you know, there was, as you may recall, there was a U.S. remake of it mm-hmm. and that kind of delayed things. And it just it took a long time. So basically, when all is said and done, my job is to be thoughtful and patient and in order to get the, you know, the best shows that I can get. You know, out in the U.S. and okay. You know, somebody, you know, so, and again, sometimes that's a question of, sometimes I'm watching the show that's already been done, you know, maybe it's a show that was done, you know, decades ago. Sometimes it's reading the script for something that hasn't been made yet, but you look at it and say, you know what, that's, you know that's the kind of show, you know, people who like to program like Broadchurch will, you know, will like that show. You know, there's a show we just put out on Acorn called Loch Ness, which is, I'll let you guess where it's, you know, where it's set.
But New Jersey.
That's a show we look, yeah, well, you know, right. But it's a show you look at and say, you know what, you know, people who enjoy a show like Broadchurch will probably, you know, find a lot to like about this show. Okay. And, you know, so it's, you know. I'm probably not doing my job justice. A, because I'm probably making it all about me, which is not true. You know.
Oh no, it's really. I was kind of curious to know. I mean, as far as, because you say you step in at different points or different stages in where a program has or hasn't in some instances yet even been produced. But when you're talking about bringing them over to the States, if it's something where, let's take it, you take that last instance you were referring to where it's something where it was still in development, you know, still yeah. in script stages, but you're already putting an eye towards its adaptability to an American audience, so you're stepping in let me know where I'm straying off the mark here, that you may step in as a partial sort of angel investor to help see that get off the ground, provided it has the rights to be brought to the States after it airs regionally.
Short answer, yeah. Short answer, yes. I mean, there's a lot of different flavors, and if I went into all the nuts and bolts again, that would be horrendously boring to all but 1% of the audience. But yeah, I mean, we come in at different points, and sometimes it is as I guess you'd say a co-producer. You know, sometimes the show that's already, you know, that's kind of been well along its way, and we say, you know what, we'll just license the rights to, you know, put it out on DVD, to put it on our streaming service, and all that. It can be there's no one path.
Okay.
But yeah, it, as I say, sometimes. But one of the things we are doing, and you know, which I will say is always a bit of a gut check, is where you say, you know, you look at something which exists only in script form and say, you know what, that's, you know, that works. Now sometimes they make it a little easy for you and they say, yes, we're doing this show, and we've got Eve Miles attached to be the lead, and you think, oh, okay. That's a little bit better, you know, and that's, you know, so it you know, when you know, casting, you know, is, that, you know, the importance of casting, you know, is amazing. You know, there was a show that we put out at Acorn, you know, 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was, that starred Peter Davison. And it was a detective series called The Last Detective. And it was one, it had never broadcast in the U.S. And it was one I looked at and said, you know what? I know, just, you know, and again, part of this was me as a Doctor Who fan knowing his popularity, but I could say, you know what, I know that there are enough people who will be interested in a detective series starring Peter Davison to make this a worthwhile show. Now, I was lucky there because the show already existed, and I was able to say, okay, yes, definitely that will work. But when you're, again, when you're looking at a script and having to say, you know, yes or no, I think probably why I joke about what I do is because there's times where I'm thinking, my God, I am putting an awful lot of weight behind my judgment.
It is a gamble. Yeah, I can absolutely see the gamble involved. Yeah,
you know. So again, you know, it's great when you know when you have a show like Doc Martin, you know, for instance, which you know stars Ian, you know, over you know Martin Clunes, a Doctor Who guest star, and Ian McNeice, another Doctor Who guest star, and you know that you know is kind of you know built up a following. Well, that's a little easier, but yeah, right. These new shows that you think is this something that will catch on is it's tricky,
right. Yeah. Well, all I can say is please just anything James Nesbitt puts his hands on, just consider that a slam dunk. I'll take Stan Lee's Lucky Man.
there's some people where you look at them and you think, yeah, I'm down with that. You know, it's like I'll take them in just about anything. You know, Toby Jones is one of those actors who Doctor Who fans will think Dream Lord, but of course he's been in, you know, Marvel Comics movies and everything else. But when you know that, you know, you see him in a show and you think, see just how good an actor he is, you think, yeah, that's something, you know, you want to bring those, you know, great performances, great stories, to the U.S. I mean, it's fun. You know, I mean, what I do is fun. I mean, like, you know, it's like, you know, I'm not like trying to, you know, it's not like I'm, you know, trying to create world peace. I mean, if I make some people happy, that's great, of course. But, you know, it's, you know, what I do is fun. I mean, it's, I'm beyond fortunate to do it. And, I will say is I got to say to Colin Baker a couple years ago at a convention, you know, in some way, I'm in this business dealing with British television because of Doctor Who. So, you know, him and Peter Davison and Sylvester and other people, the debt I owe them, I could hardly repay, let alone articulate.
Mm, well, well put. Well, let's see what we've got on the news side of things that might bring a little levity and all to the world around us here. Because we're probably going to be getting into this a little more in depth next week, not necessarily this story, but the nature of this story, I probably don't want to dive too far into it. But I'm just going to say that Bradley Walsh has been mentioned more in the news over the course of the past 7 to 10 days here on this side of the pond. Than he ever has, and probably on a global basis. Choose your own depth of research on this. But as far as the suppositions of his involvement as a potential companion or recurring character, depending on who you want to listen to and what your sources are, leads us into all kinds of murky territory. Haley, have you even given this moment thought, or is it just a matter of, okay, I'll wait until the dust settles?
I've seen this story and his name popping up a lot at this point, and it's so far away from being something that's going to affect our lives that I kind of just want to wait and see and not, you know, get too committed to this one.
Right. Yeah. That will, as I said, I think it's going to get broached next week, and we'll explain momentarily what our conversation is going to be next week and how that's going to come up. But staying on the positive side of things, I will say one of the best things that I've seen come up over the course of the past week or so, as far as news related to the Whovian scope, is something that the folks over at the Doctor Who Appreciation Society have put together. They had been doing some auctions, charity auctions, to try and support Syrian refugees that have been coming into the UK. And because Peter Capaldi and his wife Elaine consider this a cause that is very near and dear to them, being very involved in everything related to Amnesty International and on and on and on, he has donated a number of items to their latest round of auctions, but one in particular that Chris Coker, who's with us a few weeks ago, and everybody has been considering rather interesting, and that is Peter's actual script from Listen that he not only marked up, you know, for his sides and everything, but also signed, did a little write-up on, drew a little self-portrait caricature on the cover script, and on and on. So we will make sure that we link you to everything that is currently in the auction. That's one of them, and he also signed a little... was it one of the little 12-inch scale figures, I think, or maybe one of the little 9-inch scale figures?
The 5-inch ones.
Oh, the little ones. Okay. But yeah, with a great message on the front. Yeah, he wrote across the front of the box. So he damaged the box, I guess, if you want to say. It's not mint in the box. But, you know, help, I've been miniaturized, and only you can rescue me. So at current... there's still over a week to go as we're recording here, and the rehearsal script is already up to £800. So it should be a good one. Just cash in that college fund if you haven't, or maybe forego the mortgage this month, and you too can own an original rehearsal script signed by PCAP.
Yeah, you know what? The government doesn't need you to pay those student loans back. Just...
It's really just a guideline and not a rule.
I wish.
But the last thing to put in here is just and I can't even really do it justice. There's just a massive rundown of everything that has just released in the latest issue of Doctor Who magazine, including an interview with Jodie Whittaker herself. So plenty of stuff to enjoy in that. You've got interviews with Nick Briggs. You've got a great discussion with RTD, who, by the way, I believe, did he not just receive a Lifetime Achievement Award just in this past week?
Yeah, he had his speech. I've only read excerpts of it, but wonderful, just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. As well as a number of friends of ours, past guests on the show, and folks that have shared panel space with us, have all a bunch of entries into the just recently published Red, White, and Who. So if you haven't gotten a copy of that, please do, because it's got a whole lot of conversations about the Whovian fandom as it has traveled across the pond here to the States. And there's actually an extract from it that discusses Trial of a Time Lord, or what they refer to as Trail of a Time Lord, a little play on words there, because we're all just punny as heck over here. So all kinds of good stuff. And I know sometimes it takes a little bit longer to get an actual hard copy edition of Doctor Who magazine here stateside. You have to order it and wait for it to get slow boated over. But digitally, grab a hold of it just as well. It just doesn't have as many things that you can cut out and make little collage posters to put on your wall. So, but grab yourself a copy of issue 516 and let us know how it was, because I'm still reading it digitally myself. But when we convene for next week, as I alluded to, we're going to be discussing spoilers. No, I don't mean we're actually going to like find some spoilers and discuss them. We're talking about the issue of spoilers. And in our quest to really want to know everything that's going to be happening with the show that we love so much, where is that tipping point between the eagerness to know what's going to happen, or you know, what's getting shot, or who's getting cast, or you know, or what's the script synopsis and so forth, versus people who just say, you know what, I just want to be surprised. or even people that sort of straddle that line themselves, you know, and they struggle with, you know, I don't even know if I want to watch the scenes from next week, you know, when the credits are.
Are we going to get into even like varying definitions of spoilers?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I think everybody sort of paints that with their own brush. So I think it's going to be an interesting conversation. So we'll have a friend of ours, Ian's going to be coming in to join us in the studios, and it should be a good conversation. And we will definitely have to discuss things like the Bradley Walsh discussion. So it's sort of a directly related tangent. But Don, thank you so much for spending the evening chatting with us. I've really appreciated your time.
Yeah, happy to do it.
And if we want to find out a little bit more about either what it is you do or what Acorn Media does or what kind of things are coming down the pike or what we can credit you for is bringing to us on this side of the Atlantic or anything of that sort, how would we go about doing that?
Well, I'm going to let the program speak for themselves, and you can go to www.acorn.tv. And if you want to check out the service, you can get a trial membership. So I'm not even trying to take your money. Well, I mean, you might end up wanting to give it to us, but you can, you know, try it out for a bit, kind of see what we have, you know, whether it's a show like Doc Martin or something like Loch Ness, which is, just come out. We've got a lot of cool stuff. I mean, and which of course is totally self-serving of me to say, but the nice thing is I know I'm not alone in this view. So strength in numbers and all that, but yeah, it's some fun stuff, and certainly if you're a fan of Doctor Who, I can guarantee you will see more than a few familiar faces in our shows, and it's like, as I say, it's fun stuff.
Excellent. Well, for all of you at home or wherever your podcast broadcasting device is playing into your ears, this has been episode 248 of Gallifrey Public Radio. So until next week, this is Kira saying from the perspective of a producer, explanations are irrelevant. Production targets must be maintained.
This is Haley saying, I don't want it to work for them. I want it to work for me.
And this is Don Cleese saying, I'm not going to overthink any of this. Have a good night.
And we'll see you, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com. Tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
It's like sweep wheat. It's like sweep wheat. Oh, I can't say sweeps. Sweeps week. All right. You want me to start it from the top or just get that line out?
No, let's just get through that. I'll edit it later. All right.
It's like sweeps week for podcast.